We're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Byron, thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream.
Good afternoon, Danny Schechter here, your news dissector and host of this weekly program, interviewing journalists who are on top of their field in many ways and talking about what's in the news and what's not in the news. And as we meet today and speak on this Thursday, on the 17th of July, we've just received word that the Israeli army has mounted an invasion, what they're calling an incursion, what others are calling an operation on the ground in Gaza. And here to talk to us about it as it's actually happening is one of the journalists I've admired the most about coverage of what's happening in the Palestinian in Palestine, in Gaza, on the West Bank, and in terms of American policy as well. Ali Abunima, I hope I have your name right. The spelling, I'm sort of nervous about that because I like it to be proper. But, you know, we have to talk about what's going on there from a perspective that's not the perspective we read every day in the New York Times and other outlets, which seems to be a perspective of a one-sided perspective, a pro-Israeli perspective, essentially. Ali, what's happening now, as far as you know, in Gaza?
Well, right now, the situation is very bad. Everyone I'm in touch with in Gaza, whether they're in the north, in the south, in the east, in the west, is saying that the bombardment and the shelling is worse than ever since this Israeli assault began 11 days ago on the false pretext of stopping rocket fire from Gaza. The death toll as of this evening in Gaza had hit 237. According to the UN, 80% of the people who have been killed are civilians. 53 of them are children. There have been almost daily massacres of children. Yesterday, many people will have seen the massacre of four boys playing on a beach in Gaza City when they were shelled by an Israeli gunboat and killed, the four young boys from the Becker family. People heard about that largely because it happened right in front of the eyes of international journalists, but children are being killed and injured everywhere. Today, three children from a single family, three young children, were killed when their home was bombed. A four-year-old girl was killed. A four-year-old boy was killed. So that's five children just today that we know about, and goodness knows what's going on right now. And 1,770 people have been injured. Half of the injured are women and children, according to the United Nations. Since this began, 1,660 residential buildings, and many of these buildings are multi-story buildings, have been deliberately destroyed or destroyed as Israel bombs buildings near them, and a total of 9,900 people have been directly made homeless by the deliberate destruction of residential homes, according to the UN. It's staggering, really. The UN also said today that 900,000 people in Gaza, that's half the population, are without water supply. So it's an absolutely desperate situation. And tonight, Israel has gone in with ground troops.
Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, reported that the electricity was cut off in Gaza today, and that there's been shelling and artillery attacks on Gaza. Let's establish a little bit about what you do, Ali. You know, what your sources are in covering the story and what your organization is and what it does. It's a unique, independent news service and organization, which has consistently been offering coverage that you rarely see in the American media. True?
Well, that's absolutely true. And it's, I think, now more urgent than ever because of what's happening in Gaza. Our readership and viewership at electronicintifada.net has broken all records for people coming to the site and getting this news that's created by people in Gaza because they're just not getting it from the mainstream media, from the New York Times, from network television. I mean, on Monday, we had more than 500,000 visitors to our site. I think that that tells you that there's a thirst out there for people to know, unfiltered by the censored and self-censored news. I'll give you just a shocking example that emerged today. Yesterday, I mentioned the massacre of the four Bekir boys, the four children on the beach. One of the journalists who witnessed that and who talked about that was NBC correspondent Ayman Muhyiddin. He has been in Gaza previously. He was there during Israel's last attack when he was with Al Jazeera. Now he's with NBC. Today, Glenn Greenwald broke the story that NBC pulled him out of Gaza immediately after he witnessed that attack. Now, why would you do that? And then they sent in inexperienced people who don't know the area and don't know the language. It would seem that NBC thinks that the job of a correspondent in Gaza is to not report what's happening, to not witness the horrors that people are going through. And maybe Ayman Muhyiddin didn't get that message and made the mistake of actually reporting accurately
the horrifying messages. He did an amazing job of covering Gaza when virtually there were no foreign correspondents there at all. When he was working with Al Jazeera, he was a real journalistic hero before he was hired away by NBC because he was celebrated for his coverage. So here that he's been pulled out of the story he knows so well is more evidence, more information about the job that our media is doing and not doing. I was on a radio broadcast earlier today, a debate with someone in England, a blogger in England, who was telling me that that beach was actually a place that had been used to shoot rockets, and hence the attack there was defensive by Israel. I'd like your comment on that, but more importantly, why do you think the Western media, particularly American media, that you know very well, is doing such a one-sided and poor job?
They've always done a poor job on this story. I mean, you know, there are so many ills with the media that we can't, you know, probably get into all of them now. But, you know, on this story in particular, journalists, and even more than journalists, their editors and their corporate bosses are terrified of offending very vocal, very noisy pro-Israel groups. Many journalists will tell you privately, and editors, many that I speak to, that, you know, this story is the one they get the most flack for, you know, anything to do with Palestine, Israel. And the relentless bullying, the relentless intimidation from powerful pro-Israel groups, the accusations, you know, you have groups like Camera, whose business is just to harass journalists. And, you know, these are well-funded organizations. They're funded by very extreme people like Seth Klarman, who, you know, one of the key funders of the Islamophobia industry. And so there is a great deal of self-censorship.
Have you experienced this?
Don't want to run afoul of that.
Have you experienced it personally?
Well, of course, I experience it every day in the sense that I'm attacked on social media and, you know, called anti-Semitic and called all kinds of things. But, you know, I'm impervious to that. And that's the advantage of having an independent publication, is that you can actually report what's happening in Gaza, this massive attack. You can debunk the lies that Israel is telling, that this is all to do with rockets and that Israel is the innocent victim. We can get into that in a way they won't do on the BBC or NBC.
Well, let's
or
do that, if you will, because, of course, you know, when I was raising a critique of the media just a few hours ago on an international news channel, the person I was, quote, debating with immediately tried to link me to Al-Qaeda, to ISIS, to, you know, anti-Semitism, and to discredit everything I was saying as if I had this sort of preconceived notion that I was just there to bash Israel. There's a defensive there, and there's a hostility to any discourse that raises any other narratives.
Especially when that narrative is the truth. Because what one of the problems when we talk about this is, you know, there's this notion that everything is just narrative. There's the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. There's this side and there's that side. Well, you know what? There are also facts, and the job of journalists is to get at the facts. You know, you have the New York Times. Their bureau chief, Jody Reboran, whose idea of journalism, and she's expressed this publicly, is, well, you write down what one side says, and you write down what the other side says, and then you let the readers decide. How are readers going to decide? They're not in Gaza. They can't go and look at things. They can't go and inspect things themselves. Journalists are supposed to do that job and tell their readers or their viewers, you know what? The Israelis said this. The Palestinians said that. But I went and had a look myself, and this is what I found. And well, journalists are just too afraid to do that on this story.
Well, as you know, this issue has become a question of Hamas firing rockets without any rhyme or reason, according to the Israeli government, just in a vicious way at civilian targets in Israel. And Israel running a sort of measured campaign, defensive campaign, to try to stop these attacks. That's the way it's sort of being formulated by a lot of media. And, of course, you have President Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, and others denouncing Hamas, but saying very little about Israel and Israeli occupation or Israeli abuses.
Let's look at that claim, because it's the one people who consume mainstream media will hear most frequently. It's the Israeli talking point that, you know, nobody would tolerate to have rockets fired at them, and we're just doing what anyone else would do. Now, right now, as we speak, there are intense negotiations going on in Cairo to reach a ceasefire, and this is happening even as Israel is intensifying its bombing and attacks on Gaza. One of the key demands of Hamas and other factions in Gaza is to return to the November 2012 ceasefire agreement. What is that? Well, in November 2012, Israel did this. There was an eight-day-long bombardment. 170 people, again, mostly civilians, were killed. And at the end of it, Israel agreed to a ceasefire where everybody would stop firing at everyone else, and Israel would ease or substantially lift the siege of Gaza. What happened? Well, when you look at the statistics from the UN, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, it's a UN agency that keeps very careful statistics, you see that in the first 3 months after that ceasefire agreement, not one single rocket came out of Gaza, not one. At the same time, there were dozens of Israeli incursions. There were dozens of Palestinians killed and injured by Israeli attacks. We're talking about attacks on farmers, on fishermen, on just about anyone in Gaza. And nobody talks about that, and that has been the pattern repeatedly.
Well, you've
so what are Hamas demanding is go back to the ceasefire agreement and lift the siege. Is that so unreasonable? That's what Palestinians, whether they support Hamas or don't in Gaza, are all saying. Lift the siege and respect the ceasefire. Is that
you know, you've
extreme?
Actually published 5 points by Hamas, which, you know, tend to get short shrift in our media. One, opening all the crossings with the Gaza Strip. Second, opening the Rafah crossing, the link between Gaza and Egypt on a permanent basis, 24 hours a day with international guarantees that it will not be closed. A maritime corridor to Gaza. Fourth, allowing residents of the Gaza Strip to pray in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Fifth, Israel will release the prisoners who were freed as part of the earlier Shalit deal, and Israel will abide by the previous agreement reached by prisoners and the Israeli prison service with Egyptian mediation in 2012. Now, in addition to this, Israeli media has published a more expansive 10-point plan for a 10-year truce that was said to have been passed by Hamas and Islamic Jihad to Egyptian officials. So at least they have a position. But in the media, they tend to be referred to simply as the militants, militant factions. They don't, they're not given, you know, any legitimacy as a government or even as a political party.
Right. And, you know, everything you get in the media, more or less, is a reflection of the Israeli government talking point. These people are terrorists. They're irrational. They engage in violence just because. And in fact, you know, almost
not just
everything
that. They want to kill their own people. They want to kill, and they are responsible for killing Palestinian people. That's the position, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And in fact, almost everything that is said of them turns out to be true of Israel. Israel is targeting homes. Yesterday, Human Rights Watch said that they had investigated many of these Israeli attacks, and there's a clear pattern. The UN said the same thing, that Israel is targeting civilian homes and civilian objects in violation of international law. And guess what? It's not a surprise then that 80% of the people killed are civilians. It's not a surprise that there are new massacres of children every day. That's what happens when you target civilians.
How do you, as a journalist who've seen this pattern, have been reporting on this for years, keep your cool, handle, you know, your emotions in covering all of this? Because it seems as if you're a co-founder of Electronic Intifada. You're the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine and other books, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. You've been looking for a peaceful outcome. And what we're getting is more war and more tension and conflict and less information.
Well, that's a question that I ask of colleagues who are in Gaza, because right now we are so dependent on wonderful, brave journalists in Gaza, photographers, journalists who are documenting what's happening, and all, you know, so much of our reporting is dependent on them. And, you know, I find this very difficult. It's very emotional. You know, sometimes you have to edit through tears when you're reading these stories about children killed. But I think about the journalists in Gaza who are going out there to get stories when they would want to be at home with their families and children. I won't say safe at home, because no home is safe in Gaza. But, you know, people say, if we're going to die, let's die together. And these journalists are going out, and they're collecting these stories. And it's not just journalists. You know, there are also the first responders in Gaza right now who are out there rescuing lives. I think in many ways the work journalists do is just as important in Gaza, because without the work of these Palestinian journalists and photographers and videographers on the ground, we would not know what's happening. If we were relying on NBC that pulls out its best.
Well, I understand that even Rachel Maddow has not covered this issue at all.
That's true in all of the so-called progressive media. The Nation has been completely AWOL. Rachel Maddow, MSNBC, I think Chris Hayes finally had something on it the other day. But this is after, you know, more than a year without covering anything that was happening in Palestine. And again, I think this comes from the fear of this story. It comes from fear, because remember, a lot of this has to do with U.S. domestic politics. There is no pro-Palestine or pro-justice wing, really, in mainstream politics in this country. Democrats and Republicans line up in support of Israel's massacres. You take, for example, one of the sort of flagship progressive politicians in this country, supposedly, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Well, he is full square behind AIPAC, behind the far right of the pro-Israel lobby in this country, and, you know, cheering on these massacres of Palestinians. And many other so-called progressive politicians are like that. And that's reflected in the progressive media as well.
What is your view?
That's why we need independent media and independent voices to break through this wall of, this shameful wall of silence.
Well, you're singing my song here, of course. This is what we've been doing on mediachannel.org and what I've been doing, you know, for it seems like forever. Your site, electronicintifada.net, offers a wide range of information. But do you cover the accusations against Hamas, the feeling that Hamas is irresponsible and it's not acting, you know, in accord even with its own principles? How do you handle that internal debate among the Palestinian community about issues like this and the use of, you know, missile attacks? Is this something that concerns you?
Well, of course, one thing that we provide, and I wish more media did this, is provide a space for Palestinians themselves to give their opinions, to write their opinions. And, you know, you come to the Electronic Intifada, you'll find a diversity of Palestinian voices debating these issues. Although, you know, when the bombs are falling on Gaza, when whole families are being wiped out, Palestinians tend to come together. I don't think that can surprise anyone. But in general, these debates are there and they're present, and we talk about them. But I think the crucial thing is, before you ask people to make up their mind about any issue, you need to inform them. And that's really our primary goal. You want to talk about whether Hamas is irrational or terrorist or extremist or whatever you want to call it. Well, that's fine. But first, know what the facts, know what their positions are. You want to call Mahmoud Abbas a moderate or a peacemaker or whatever it is you want to call him, that's fine. But first, know the facts. Know what he's up to. Know what, you know, who supports him and so on and so forth. These are the kinds of issues that just get totally ignored in the mainstream.
I mean, it's as if there's no background and context being offered or perspectives being offered. I know, you know, in England, Greg Filo, who's a media analyst and researcher, spent many years looking at the coverage of Palestine and Israel, but also looking at what the British public actually knew about these issues, what they were being taught in school, what their media outlets were presenting in terms of in-depth background pieces, and found that it wasn't surprising that people's opinions are manipulated because they're starting with such a zero base of knowledge about what's going on. And that's certainly true here.
It's absolutely right. And one of the big stories here is how atrociously the BBC has done. And Greg Filo, I know, has looked closely at the BBC coverage, but it's worse than ever. Amina Salim, one of our regular writers, has been documenting the really shoddy and biased and highly politicized coverage of the BBC on this issue for some time. And it's gotten so bad that literally thousands of people have been protesting outside BBC studios across the UK in the past few days. They had a huge protest at the main BBC headquarters in London on Tuesday. Thousands of people, and saying, you know, this is a public broadcaster. We pay for this. We demand to get adequate and impartial coverage of what's happening in Gaza. But people are watching it, and what they're seeing instead, and I know this. I grew up with the BBC. I listen to it every day, the World Service. It has become like a public relations service for the Israeli army.
Well, let's just close our conversation, because you very kindly gave us 20 minutes. And, you know, on this day of all days when there's so many developments going on, I don't want to go beyond that 20 minutes, which is rapidly coming to an end. But share with our listeners, our readers on mediachannel.org, what sources you turn to for news and information that's reliable. What is the responsibility of the viewer and the reader to get the truth and to try to understand the complexities of these issues?
Well, I think that you have to go to many, many sources, and not everyone has time to do that, but that is one thing we do, and we bring it together for people, and then we do it in a very transparent way because people can see where we're getting the information. They can check it out themselves. So I think independent media, like the Electronic Intifada, like your show, Danny, like others, are so crucial, and people need to support them, you know? I mean, often people say, well, we're glad you're there, but, you know, we're only here in the end because people are willing to listen, to read, to share, and to make sure that we have the resources to do that work.
Does it feel sometimes like lonely work, Ali, you know, of being out there in a media culture that really would prefer you didn't exist?
You know, I'm sure it's felt that way at times, but right now I feel part of a very big and growing community of solidarity. New people are coming to us every day. And I tell you, what keeps me sane and hopeful in this is how many people are really hungry and thirsty for reliable information, for analysis that takes them seriously, that treats them as intelligent people. And I feel very fortunate and lucky that through whatever accidents got me to where I am, I have the opportunity to do that work and to do it with really fantastic colleagues. So I don't feel lonely at all.
Well, thank you so much, Ali Abunima, Electronic Intifada. ElectronicIntifada.net is the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. There'll be more.
You were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
The station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by Coke, by...
Wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
40% of the stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is a gentrification.
I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, talking about media coverage of Israel and Palestine today. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, an American writer, journalist, and blogger, formerly with the Daily Beast, and Al-Akhbar. He's the author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, in 2009, and Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. He's produced several short video reports posted on YouTube, among other websites. He has a very strong perspective based on actual reporting, being actually there and talking to people about what's happening in Israel. We're talking today, Max, as Israeli ground troops are invading Gaza, as this campaign is likely to produce even more casualties and more death in the occupied entity of Gaza, which is, of course, part of the Palestinian community. What's your thoughts? What are you hearing about what's happening there?
Well, the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has claimed that this is an effort to destroy tunnels. This follows by to destroy supposed rocket launching sites. And in the past week or so, the Israeli military killed over 200 people in the Gaza Strip, 25% of them children, over 80% civilians, according to the UN, and then gone on in U.S. media dispatching people like Ambassador Ron Dermer to claim that those people were all human shields. Yesterday, Israeli naval gunners who maintain the Israeli naval cordon off of the Gaza coastline, who routinely fire on Gazan fishermen, began lobbing shells onto the beach right in front of a hotel, the Roots Hotel, where dozens of reporters stay. They found a group of Palestinian boys around age 12 playing soccer on the beach. They missed with the initial salvo and readjusted the fire in order to make sure that they had killed all of these boys, four boys, in front of a group of journalists. Then went on to CNN, claimed human shields. The incident was actually photographed and videotaped, so there is really no excuse. The U.S. State Department blamed Hamas for the killing of the four boys, exonerating Israel from all responsibility, and, you know, next day green-lighted the invasion of the Gaza Strip, which Israel claims is aimed at tunnels, but which will only, which will primarily destroy civilian targets. Israel has just destroyed the Al-Wafa Hospital in Gaza City, which is a geriatric rehabilitation hospital, the only one of its kind, after a really dramatic evacuation. Evacuated on their own by a group of international volunteers. Following a five-hour, quote-unquote, humanitarian ceasefire honored by Israel, minutes afterwards, the shelling began, leaving seven children dead and three adults, and we're hearing reports of massive civilian casualties from inside the Gaza Strip. While the U.S., while Americans remain kind of captivated by other news, and the Obama administration sends its full-throated support.
So one of the things that we've also just heard is that the Israeli government has told reporters in Gaza to stay in their hotels.
No, to leave their hotel. They evacuated them.
Evacuate them from their hotels. So,
or they forced them to leave their hotel, and they're now sheltering at a Palestinian press center.
So is there an attempt here to control the media coverage on Israel's part, not just on the ground inside Gaza, but generally speaking? What, you've been to Israel. How does that work?
Israel doesn't need a whole lot of help controlling the media. The media controls itself. Just look at what happened to Ayman Moadin, who had been at the beachfront massacre, was playing soccer with the little boys moments before the massacre, and then took to social media to tweet about the experience of playing soccer with little boys who are fishermen's sons, and then watching them shattered, watching their bodies shattered to pieces on the beach by Israeli naval gunners who have some of the most advanced locating and targeting systems in the world. Ayman then proceeded to film the mother of the boys as she learned the news that they had just been killed. And this harrowing footage made its way onto NBC News moments afterwards. I noticed that Ayman was forced to delete his postings on social media and was then removed from the Gaza Strip by NBC and has been replaced by Richard Engel, who is one of the, you know, classic Washington foreign policy reporters who never absorbs the pain of the victims whose suffering he's documenting. And if you look at Richard Engel's Twitter timeline, it's been exclusively about rocket launchings, isolated rocket launchings from the Gaza Strip. No footage, no images, no description of the pain of the people who he's embedded among. So, you know, NBC is doing a great job of controlling itself. The rest of the U.S. media has been completely self-censoring, with the notable exception of the Huffington Post, which is the one mainstream outfit I can think of that has, I think, accurately conveyed the kind of one-sided massacre that this military operation, Protective Edge, has been.
Why is that, do you think? I mean, what accounts for, you know, the complicity of the American media in all this, the lack of independence, the lack of offering context and background? This is a pattern that is not new. It's gone on for years and years.
There's definitely a fear of, you know, pro-Israel outfits like Camera. I think it's an unjustified or fear because, you know, these groups don't have as much power as mainstream media thinks. And we've seen, you know, when reporters with some independent streaks actually take on the Israeli narrative, they're rewarded and they're applauded by their audiences. I'm thinking about Jon Stewart or Bob Simon from 60 Minutes. what I think the problem is it's a cultural problem within the media. The mainstream media is predominantly male, predominantly white, and heavily Jewish. These are demographics that support Israel, or at least sympathetic to Israeli claims, and can't fathom the idea that Israel is an apartheid state that is engaged in the ongoing dispossession and domination of an indigenous population. They see Israel as a normal democracy, and that's the culture inside the newsroom.
Let me tell you a little story, if I may, of my own experience in this regard. Actually, I was at ABC News 2020, and ABC had run this piece that was objected to very strongly by Arab experts and the Arab community, and they demanded that ABC do something to correct a piece that they ran. And ABC's response was to commission a piece about Arab stereotypes in the movies, you know, which didn't speak to any of the concerns that were raised. And so the group that was critical of ABC came back and said, do you guys have the guts to go there and just speak to Palestinians about three issues, hospital care, water, and, the diversion of water, and education? And they said, well, do you guys have the guts to even cover that, to get, you know, what Palestinians say about this? And then you can get comments from Israeli officials or whatever, but the officials who are actually responsible for the problem. So ABC said, well, of course we have the courage to do it. How dare you question that? So they commissioned a piece that aired in 1981. Okay. A piece that actually went into all these issues. And in the course of doing it, they found that no Israeli official who was responsible for any of the problems that they were covering would agree to be interviewed. Also, they found that representatives of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, sent representatives to New York to lobby the executives at ABC not to run the piece. But ABC said, look, we offered you opportunities to comment. We only wanted comment on these three issues. And you turned us down repeatedly. And this was said in the introduction to the piece. Okay. So the piece airs. Okay. But the night that it airs, I happen to be in the main lobby of our program 2020. And suddenly several trucks arrive, FedEx trucks, bringing in telegrams and letters to ABC objecting to this program. The problem was the letters were delivered before the program aired. Okay. So nobody had seen it because it, you know, hadn't been broadcast yet. But nevertheless, there was an orchestrated letter writing campaign to pressure ABC not to run it. ABC, to its credit, did run it, but to my knowledge, never ran anything like it again. But, you know, it seems like that this is a extremely organized campaign to try to dominate and threaten media organizations.
This is, you know, there's so many stories like that, and it's unfortunate that they get lost in the Orwellian memory hole, because each one needs to be documented. They haven't really been compiled in a book. It needs to happen. About networks just capitulating to Israeli pressure campaigns against all rules of journalistic ethics and all standards of journalistic integrity. I write in my book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, about Carl Vick, Times correspondent in Jerusalem, who I knew, who was a very fair correspondent, really solid reporter, a rare commodity in that area. And he did a piece called Why Israel Doesn't Need Peace, about how Israel had established a one-way peace and didn't need an agreement with the Palestinians to continue going forward. It's kind of like conventional wisdom at this point. The ADL freaked out, the Anti-Defamation League. They went to Time executives, and Time has a number of very pro-Israel executives. And, you know, I've been told this by a correspondent at Time, that Time then sent its managing editor, Richard Engel, to Jerusalem to produce a piece called Can Netanyahu Make Peace? And they ran Netanyahu on the cover, waving, and it was portraying Netanyahu as a peacemaker. This is back in, I think, 2010. And they had run the same exact cover during Netanyahu's first term as prime minister. I think the first cover was in 1993. So time basically did Netanyahu a favor, because pro-Israel organizations and the Israeli government had protested accurately. We're seeing this over and over again. I think what we need to be asking right now is, what is the story behind Moadin's reassignment from the Gaza Strip? This is a star reporter, someone who covered Operation Cast Lead in 2008, 2009 for Al Jazeera and did the most admirable job.
And won many awards.
More than any correspondent.
Was very
He's an Arab-American, and he has now just been ousted without explanation.
Well, you've been into, to Israel. You've written about Israel. You've grown up in a Jewish American culture, as I have. What is it that you find? I mean, you've indicted racism in Israel, attitudes of extreme hostility, if not hate, against all Palestinians. What's the cause of all of this? Why is this type of attitude, which went from has gone from the margins to the mainstream and seems to be dominating the discourse?
Well, those attitudes have always been there. And there have always been horrendous massacres of Palestinians even inside the Green Line in Israel, like Kfar Qassem in 1956, that were covered up. Extremely racist, even genocidal attitudes among Jewish Israelis have been documented as early as 1963. And I cite them in my book, Goliath. But what we're seeing now is kind of these attitudes are being encapsulated a religious messianic narrative that is extremely dangerous, while democratic elements in Israel shrink, go into exile, or simply retreat into their shell. So, I mean, if we're seeing them mainstream, I don't know if I would put it that way. They're simply intensifying, or they're expressed in a more bellicose way. The reason that they exist is because you're talking about a settler colonial society that's been engaged in this constant 66-year-old project of dominating and controlling a restive indigenous population. All young Israelis at age 18 have to conscript into the military and participate in an occupation army. That's not a natural act. And so beginning in preschool and in kindergarten, the culture of militarization seeps into the lives and the psyche of young Israelis, and the other, the Palestinian, is demonized, placed against the frame of existential threats to Jews and thousands of years of Jewish oppression, so that they bear the weight of Jewish persecution. This is incredibly dangerous, and it's what we've seen with the Death to Arabs mobs pouring out in the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem since this.
Well, you've waded into these mobs. You haven't just stood on the sidelines. You've gone in with video cameras and actually talked to these people. Tell us about that experience. It must be frightening.
Well, you see just raw hooliganism. After the massacre on the Mavi Marmara, the Free Gaza Flotilla, hundreds of Israelis spontaneously appeared outside the Turkish embassy in Tel Aviv. And I videotaped this. You can see it on YouTube. And they were filled with, just regular people screaming at an empty office building because Turkey had backed the Free Gaza Flotilla, calling them Al-Qaeda, holding pictures of Hitler next to Prime Minister Erdogan. And then their ranks were filled with soccer hooligans from the Maccabi Fanatics and Beitar Jerusalem, who are the two main groups of ultras in Israel. And those are groups that are behind a wave of hate crimes against Palestinian citizens of Israel and vandalism of Palestinian property, of churches, anything that has non-Jewish symbols.
Are they controlled by the Israeli police or encouraged by the Israeli police?
Well, in a lot of ways, this hasn't been explored sufficiently, but just like Golden Dawn in Greece, they have infiltrated the police, and the police, while they maintain a presence, and I've seen them actually stop horrible violence, they allow violence to occur at least some level My colleague David Sheen was attacked by a group of right-wing fanatics who were on an anti-African rampage in Tel Aviv, and I videotaped part of it. You can see it in my and Sheen's documentary, Israel's New Racism, on YouTube. And they started slapping Sheen and attacking him, and a police commander was standing right there, and I said, are you going to let them attack a journalist? And he just shrugged and said, yeah. Last week in Tel Aviv, a small group of anti-war protesters appeared at Rabin Square in North Tel Aviv to protest the attack on Gaza. And they were set upon by right-wing thugs from the Maccabi Fanatics, the ultras of the Tel Aviv soccer club, including young men wearing neo-Nazi T-shirts that read,
these are
good
Jews.
Night left side. If you look up the phrase good night left side, you will see that this is one of the main T-shirts worn by skinheads in the U.S. and neo-Nazis in Europe. And these Maccabi fanatics had custom-made them, these T-shirts. These are homegrown Jewish Israelis wearing neo-Nazi T-shirts attacking leftists.
It seems
I think
as
there's
if...
no more dangerous place, Danny, for a left-wing Jew to be right now than in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv.
And yet the mainstream Jewish organizations that rally behind Israel don't talk about this at all, do they? They sort of cover it up or they conceal it.
No, it's shocking. They're allowing this to proceed. And, you know, what we see with these young Jews in Israel who are being indoctrinated into a culture of militarization and eliminationist racism is a victimization of young people and young Jewish minds. I mean, I've always said that Zionism is a prison for Palestinian bodies and Jewish minds. These young Jews are victims, too. They're put in an impossible situation. And pro-Israel organizations, which are run by some, by basically wealthy old men who've elected themselves to these positions, who have all the privilege in the world, are not intervening.
They're all citing the Holocaust. Okay, to me, the most vivid memory of the Holocaust is what happened to the Warsaw Ghetto. And the Warsaw Ghetto, in a way, is a parallel with what's happening in Gaza, isn't it? I mean, no parallel ever is. But the idea of a subjugated, occupied community that's being punished collectively for the actions of individuals and with a disproportionate amount of violence and hatred and people in the Israeli government, you know, literally saying it's time to finish them all, which is a genocidal call.
What is the Gaza Strip, if not a besieged ghetto, filled with racially outcasted, heavily demonized unpeople who cannot be allowed to leave because of the circumstances of their birth? That, to me, is a parallel to the Warsaw Ghetto and to other ghettos throughout history and to ghettos that we see right in our own backyard. So what I think is ironic is that so many people who revere the Jewish ghetto fighters would like to see those fighters in Gaza go like lambs to the slaughter, and they won't do it. I think that they have a right to defend themselves just as Jews under occupation in World War II Europe did.
Well, what do you say to the people saying, look, Hamas is shooting rockets at civilian populations. Hamas is irresponsible. Hamas wants to kill Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, it's the classic case of blaming the victim. Hamas was elected in the Gaza Strip and is firing rockets to demonstrate deterrent capacity. You're talking about the open-air prison versus the fourth most powerful military in the world. A superpower military with nuclear weapons, with a blue water navy. We're supposed to hold this para-government responsible for firing homemade rockets with a negligible payload that can barely be aimed into the areas from where many of them were expelled from. And we're supposed to hold them responsible for the precision-guided missiles, which are destroying and shattering the civilian population.
And shouldn't we
it's
add
really
that,
one of the most sickening narratives.
And shouldn't we also add that the United States government is involved in providing some of these weapons, over $3 billion a year in military assistance to Israel, which goes without comment or note reporting in most of our media?
Well, Barack Obama yesterday stood before the Washington press corps and said he was heartbroken by the images of civilian suffering in Gaza. But he never shed a tear when he sent those weapons to Israel. He personally authorized the shipments of those weapons to Israel that were used to inflict that suffering. It was absolutely disingenuous.
There's also a historical note.
Detach himself from the killing.
A historical note I didn't want to forget totally, which was that Israel actually helped create Hamas. Israel, positioned and promoted Hamas as an alternative to the PLO under Yasser Arafat. Israel is involved in all of this. This was not something that just happened. It was supported by Israel, was it not?
Was supported with Israel, and this has been widely reported by the UK Independent, with 100 million shekels in support for Hamas-related organizations. But the real support that Israel gave was that when Israel controlled the Gaza Strip directly, it allowed Hamas-related elements run by Sheikh Yassin and Rantisi to pretty much operate unchecked throughout the Gaza Strip, while they officially banned the PLO and kept Fatah underground. So they allowed Hamas to flourish as the means of crushing the secular Fatah, which has now been brought to heel in the West Bank under the completely compliant Abbas. Now what we're seeing is that Hamas has actually managed to maintain order in the Gaza Strip. It even operates anti-rocket squads to prevent independent factions from launching rockets during ceasefires. It maintained the 2012 ceasefire, and we're seeing Saudi Arabian intelligence backing Salafi elements to the far right of Hamas in the Gaza Strip to create further destabilization. After Hamas, these are the kind of groups that will fill the void, groups we're seeing fill the void in Iraq.
And many people who voted for Hamas, when asked why, they didn't come back with a lot of religious mumbo-jumbo. They said Hamas is not corrupt. Hamas provides services to the community. They're responsive to community needs. That seemed to be why they built and how they built the support that they had.
That's the number one reason. The number two reason is that Hamas engages in actual resistance, while Fatah, which controls the Palestinian Authority, basically sits there with its hands tied as Israel builds more and more settlements. You look at the city of Qalqilia in the West Bank, which was completely surrounded on all sides by the separation wall. Just imagine living in a city surrounded on all sides by a wall, a literal prison. That city in the 2006 Palestinian legislative elections voted overwhelmingly for Hamas. And it was not an Islamist city. It was simply because they blamed Fatah and the Palestinian Authority for allowing that wall to be built around it.
So
and they wanted to resist.
As you're reporting, I don't mean to cut you off, but we only have a few minutes left, and I want to try to bring these points out that, the story is presented in a kind of good guy, bad guy narrative, as so much of our foreign policy. The terrorists are the bad guys. We're the good guys. Israel is the good guy. Hamas is the bad guy. And there's this simplification with no context, no background, and no analysis. And as a consequence, Americans tend to not only be supportive of their government when it's explained this way. It's either us or the barbarians. That's how it seems to be presented to many Americans, and the media is part of presenting it that way.
Well, there's no context provided to Americans about the Gaza Strip and what it is or why it is the way it is, and that's the most dangerous thing. And we see that same kind of reporting on inequality in the United States or crime. There's never any context. It's just, these poor people who just aren't taking risks, or these wild super predators running through our streets. We don't know about their lives. People on the Gaza Strip are mostly refugees. 80% of them are descended from people who are expelled from what is now Israel, and they can't return because they're not Jews. That is the only reason they're in this overcrowded ghetto, and of course it's going to lead to violence.
Well, you know, Max, just to, you know, tell you that, you know, I have a great deal of admiration for your courage in covering this, for your speaking out on these issues, for challenging, in a way, your own community and maybe even your own family to try to put these issues out there that sometimes must be a little lonely, or am I wrong?
Well, I have support from my family, and I'm lucky for that. And I think the dynamics of Jewish life in the U.S. are shifting around this issue. I go from campus to campus, and I meet young Jews who have just decided that they can't support what Israel's doing anymore, and they're taking action. And we're building on a long tradition of critical journalism that you helped start at WBCN. So this isn't something new here. We're just kind of, it's continuous, and we're trying to build, and just having been around the country since October promoting my book, something is really happening out there that is actually exciting.
Well, final word. Thank you so much, Max Blumenthal. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for doing the work that you do. I think it's very gutsy, and I think it's very important, particularly to have a new generation involved in re-scrutinizing issues that have been missing in our media. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Danny.
And you'll be able to hear this program on the PRN archive. Now, let me say this again. You'll be able to hear this program on mediachannel.org and the archive and other places. So thanks again for being part of this program. Chase and to war.